This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Julia Scatliff O'Grady likely inherited her interest in time. Her parental family all worked at the Elgin Watch Factory in Illinois when the wristwatch first hit the mass market. Her dad, now in his 80s, still wears his boyhood wristwatch. And her childhood home had a grandfather clock that would chime every 15 minutes. Yet finding the time to accomplish her goals eluded her. So she attended several time management seminars, and then she started to teach time management seminars, and yet her frustration with time persisted. So instead of trying to manage it, she decided to study it. She profiled several people with unique approaches to time in her new book, Good Busy, and Julia O'Grady is here today to tell us what she's learned. Welcome, Julia. Good to have you here.
Great to be here.
Also with us is Alan Combs, who joins us by phone from his home in Northern California. Alan is a professor emeritus at UNC Asheville and is the director of the Center for Consciousness Studies at California Institute for Integral Studies in San Francisco. Alan Combs, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good to have you here. Julia, let me ask you first. You started your professional life as an activist. What did that teach you about time?
Well, being an activist takes a lot of time, and it takes faith that what you believe in will happen. And some of the things that you believe in may not happen in your own lifespan. So I learned that. I also learned that when you ask people to volunteer, when you ask people to come to a meeting, they will quickly jump into all of the things they have to do. And that really wasn't my question.
They always have enough time to tell you how busy I am.
That's correct.
Kind of a great phenomenon. But it is interesting, these two scales that you're working with that get introduced right away. Number one, if you want to bring about social justice to planet Earth, you better be patient. And so the idea of this very long time frame that you're looking at. And on the other hand, there are the meetings, there are the activities, there's the rally to plan and all the activities that have to be timed in a very, very narrow set of time ranges.
That's right. And in our culture, the number one word we use alongside time is to manage it. And I think we all know that we can't do anything to time. So it's some word that means something else. And I guess that's what set me off on a journey.
So Alan Combs, tell us about this time through the ages and how our perception of time has changed. Certainly, we haven't always thought about time in the way we do, here in the 21st century.
Well, you know, that's a long story.
Well, we've got time. I'm sorry.
They say time is nature's way of keeping everything from happening all at once, you know. Over the course of history, and if you look at different cultures, people have different experiences of time. I think historically, if you go back far enough, and still in some primary cultures, time is cyclic. When people say this time next year, they really mean that because time cycles from year to year. And then eventually it became a kind of progress. A lot of that happened with the Judeo-Christian point of view that God is, in some sense, writing his will in history. So history becomes a kind of book, and time moves forward and things change. So that was probably the first time people thought about time as a kind of progressive process. But, you know, it's only recently people have been in a panic about it. And I remember reading not long ago the letters of a writer, I don't remember who, but turn-of-the-century writer who, he got started because he got a job in England, in London. It was a London, an Englishman. He had to come up with logos for companies. And he had to come up with 3 or 4 a week. And if he did that, he had the rest of his time to himself. He had an office and so on. That was considered a reasonable job. So he would sit in his office, go for walks. He would come up with a logo every day or two. The rest of the time was on his own. Nobody really worried about this. Even though labor forces since the Industrial Revolution, people have worked on sort of on a clock, I guess. But it's only recently that, in the 20th century, and probably the second half of the 20th century, I guess we're going to have a historian with us later, but there's this hurry-up business. so that, you know, there are accountants now and other people who work on, you know, 5 minutes or 10 minute blocks. They have to really account for themselves at that rate. I mean, that's kind of
right. I guess
for a heart attack.
Sure. Well, once you commodify labor and sort of carve it up into units, particularly if somebody else is going to profit from your units,
yeah,
that changes everything. And and talk about heart attacks. So, Juliet, now, and I take from reading your book that you've been to these time management seminars, and you're pretty sure they don't work too well.
I can't know if they don't work for everyone. I think the challenge is that many of the folks who sat beside me and around me had been sent by their bosses. Their bosses weren't able to enforce a new discipline, so they were sent to learn. Also, what you go in to spend a day with must then be translated into your everyday life. And we all have a relationship with time that starts the minute we're born. The minute we're born, we get that date stamp that we were born at 10:47 p.m., that within a couple days, you know whether that baby's a morning baby or a night one. And that's a long time to spend with your own relationship to then be sent to a hotel ballroom for one day to correct.
And, of course, as you suggest, we're not managing time. We're managing ourselves within time. I mean, that's
well,
the key.
Well, that's right. I think what's interesting about this conversation so far is that the efficiency discourse has now become a part of our everyday life so much that we don't even know the difference between working in a factory setting and being in our home. We have play dates with our children, which are specified times that children play together. We have quality time. All of these are increments of productivity that we have transposed to interpersonal relationships.
And we can't imagine downtime. And Ellen, you mentioned this this kind of Judeo-Christian or Judeo concept of time being eschatological, that moves forward through history. And yet built into the very origins of that tradition was the day of rest. There will be a moment, there will be a time when you're not doing something. Creation depends
on
it.
You know, that's what we have a lot of things like that. You know, the Newtonian physics was conceived as the way God had created the universe, and it worked great. So then people later said, well, it works great, but we don't need the God part. And and we got the same thing with time now. You know, God created the world in 7 days, and one day you rest. Oh, well, but yeah, but we don't need that. Stay to rest, we can get a little more done.
We can get
but,
more done.
You know, Europeans are different. It's really interesting. I don't know how it is right now, but, you know, with all the economic problems with the euro, but a few years ago, people did surveys in Europeans, and they would rather work a 4-day week and have a day at home, and a lot of them do. That's their choice. You ask Americans, they'll say, no, I'd rather work 6 days and get more. So, I'd rather have a motorcycle in the garage and another couple of TVs, and I'll work for that. Whereas Europeans, typically, you know, the men get 2 or 3 years leave in some countries when they have a baby. The men I'm talking about, not even the women. We would never dream of something like that. Time's too precious here and forget getting things done.
Well, it's a little through the looking glass, isn't it, to say I will make myself so miserable that I can now buy the thing that will relieve my misery.
Oh, well, but that's what's going to make me happy, don't you know?
And doesn't it ever? And how rarely it happens. So, Julie, let's talk about some of the examples in your book. You talked to a guy named Joe Kennedy who worked for Mr. Rogers.
He did.
Of all people. And so tell us what Joe learned about Mr. Rogers and what we can all learn about time from Mr. Rogers' routines.
Well, the first thing to know about Mr. Rogers is that he's still loved. All these many years after his last program, his death, there are still college students who I teach who grew up with Mr. Rogers. And what Joe told me about Mr. Rogers is that he was the same on screen as off. So the routine that he showed for kids on television, he had an equally strong routine in the office, where he got up at 4 a.m, came into work. By 9:30, he hit the pool and swam. He came back. He had his cottage cheese at noon for lunch, always cottage cheese. But Joe, who I interviewed, struggled because he didn't have that kind of routine. He admired that in Mr. Rogers, and that's what I really loved about talking with him, that they could have this friendship, but knowing that Joe would stay up until 4 a.m. and drink Diet Coke and smoke and do all the things that Mr. Rogers didn't do. But they bonded around this notion that there should be some things in your everyday life that you can count on.
And well, let me say something about that, too, because it would be interesting to see what Mr. Rogers was doing when he was 30 years old and creating his career. And I say this because I've read some about George Burns. By the way, I thought that was a wonderful part of your book, Julia.
Oh, thank you.
And really recommend the book. It's a great little book. It's a wonderful read, and it's time appropriate. You can read this book in a couple of hours.
Time well spent.
You can read it before dinner and then talk about it over dinner. You can read it after dinner, and you'd be ready to go to bed. But George Burns, you know, I don't know how long he lived. I guess he's still not alive, but he I'm not even sure about that. But he didn't die in 1996. But he was, on TV at 100. And I read an article about him. A reporter went around with him. He was just like Mr. Rogers. He was very old, and his 24-hour cycle was exactly the same every day. And he took assistants with him when he traveled so that he would have the same food, he would have the same time of day, he would do the same thing the same time. And, you know, I think this is a routine. Now, this is no criticism of what you're saying, because I think that's a great chapter, and I think this is a very useful, having some kind of routine. It's absolutely necessary, or, you know, we could talk about all kinds of problems that we could come
but
along. But
tell you what we're going to do, Ellen. We're going to take a break right now because we are out of time, but then we're going to come back and continue this conversation with Julia O'Grady. We are coming back, so stay with us. Ellen Combs, the UNC Professor Emeritus, and we're talking about time on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, today talking about time, how we perceive it, how we use it, how it uses us, how it overwhelms us, and how we can become comfortable with it. Julia Scatliff O'Grady is with us. She is the author of a new book, Good Busy. Ellen Combs is a consciousness researcher and a professor emeritus at UNC Asheville. He's talking with us from California. Joining us now are two of Julia's subjects. Kari Andrade is a financial advisor here in the Triangle. Tom Rankin is a photographer and the director for the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Thanks, Frank.
Kari, your chapter in Julia's book is called Buffer. This is your theory of time management, or maybe a life force for you. Tell us about the buffer and how it works for you.
Well, I didn't know it was a theory until Julia discovered it. This is just the way I am with time. I like to be on time. My first boss told me showing up on time is late and early is on time. And so I got used to doing that. And it took me 20 minutes to get here, so I planned a half an hour because you just never know. And I don't mind being a little early. Then I can be more efficient. I can relax. I'm better. I'm a better person. I'm a better me when I'm on time or early.
Well, the other thing I took from your chapter is not only are you better prepared and perhaps more efficient, and I think you just mentioned it, but you're less anxious. It's like, why wait to the last second, and then when the guy in front of you, you know, slows down and makes you miss the red light, you scream because you're late.
Absolutely. I'm more relaxed, right? Yeah. And I am more forgiving of other people when they're late if I'm on time and relaxed. And I like to go through life being a little more relaxed and a little more happy than being uptight and angry.
So you have this theory, and it's perfectly rational. By the way, it's my theory. I believe the whole world should subscribe to this.
Absolutely.
Because when you and I are not anxious, and when you and I are happy, the people around us are happy.
Absolutely.
But it turns out the people around us don't buy the theory. Have you tried to sell your theory to someone who just can't make a buffer for themselves?
Well, I haven't found that that's worked. But what I have found that's worked for me is that if I know somebody is habitually late, then I allow for that. And so, or, you know, if we're going somewhere, I might tell my husband we're going to leave at 2 o'clock when actually if we left at 2:15, we'd get there on time. And then all that time that it takes to get out the door, I'm not upset.
Do you take responsibility for their buffer?
I do.
And don't build it in. Julia, it's interesting what Kari just said, which is she didn't know she had a theory until she talked to you. Was that what you found in talking with the people that you were asking about time, that they were sort of thinking about how they use time perhaps for the first time?
When I first started working on this project, I called it Tick. And so it ended up being TikTok. You know, I like to think and talk about time. And I like to listen to how people talk about time because the way they talk about it is their relationship with it. And I know when I first started to date my husband, I was clear that we had very different relationships with time. And I had a sense that that would change after marriage, that would change after the first couple of years. And I came to realize there's only an amplification over time.
Yeah.
Now with Kari, I've known her a long time, and I am always panicked because I know that if I'm late, there will be some judgment cast on that.
Even if she's smiling, even if she's relaxed, you know in her heart she's condemned you.
And that's always been the challenge when I was trying to be a time management expert and leading seminars. If I was not punctual, people would not take anything else seriously.
Yeah.
So,
you know, I have a strategy for that. I get in the car, and at first I'm tempted to panic. I'm going to be late, and then I tell myself, hey, guess what? It's not the end of the world if I get there late. I'll get there when I get there. And that's it. I just make up my mind, and I don't worry about it.
Yeah, but it's an interesting thing, Ellen. That is a kind of arch philosophy. It's, you know, this is my life, and it's happening in real time, and I can't. We can't change it. The circumstances are mine.
Yeah,
but it becomes a part of it. It's because you manage time, because you thought about how you use time.
I think what's important when you talk about matters of time and being on time, it's a power relationship. There's some of us who punch clocks when they come into work. They are not trusted unless there's a time put on that. And then there are, within the corporate arena, there are people who can show up late or take 2 hours for lunch. I mean, time can be an issue of power and control. And some of us are very lucky. We aren't observed in that manner, and others of us really struggle.
Well, Tom, Julia called your chapter Sliver, trying to emphasize that you have a lot of things going on. You're a photographer. You're the head of CDS. You're a goat herd. And all of that takes time in their own right. They could all be professions. And you tell us how you manage those different functions. It's not – you don't call it multitasking.
No, and I don't – and I'm not sure that – I mean, it's ironic that I'm in a time management book because I don't think of myself as doing any more than trying to take advantage of all that I have in terms of hours, minutes, to do the things I want to do. There's a I quote this often, but a little store had this saying, when all is said and done, more will have been said than done. And I try to adopt the reverse of that. And it's not so much to be frenetic or even to multitask, but I have a list of things I want to get done. And I've found that these little gaps between things is often the great gifts of time. And so that's where I must have used that word sliver. It's not a word I didn't have a theory of time.
Well, it became a chapter heading.
It became a chapter heading.
But let me ask you about that, because it did sound from the description that you really focus. You are in the moment. So all of these other ideas and pressures are around you. But when you're tending the goats, you're tending the goats.
Yeah, I do use those sort of skills of denying all the other lists to focus on one thing on the list. And, you know, I don't open your email if I don't have time to think about this particular thing. I have all these little – developed all these skills, I suppose, and that's the only way I can do it. Some of it, the academic life, you know, you go into a class, and for that hour and a half, it's those 15 students and nothing else. So there are ways the day is structured that way, the way that time gets structured. But I think I do divide things up like that.
You know, one thing I've noticed over the years watching young people, usually students, develop – some of them into successful professionals and some of them not, is there's a real shift as you grow in learning to go from one task to another without downtime. Now, that could be the sliver time, but when you know, be able to put something down, go immediately to something else and be involved with it. So a lot of young people I know, I say, well, I need a day for this. Well, I need a couple of days to shift gears. And, you know, they don't get much done.
Yeah. Well, you know, the other thing I wanted to ask you about, Alan, too, is this question of being focused, being in the moment, so focused on what you're doing that it's all consuming, no matter what the pressures are. In a way, that can be somebody's definition of eternity. Eternity is not all the a lot of time. It's, frankly, no time. It's where time evaporates.
You know, we talk about people who are in a flow state, and that's a kind of total absorption in what you're doing. And there's some, you know, there's some characteristics of that. It usually is some task, like photography, or for me, like writing or sailing a boat, being a sailor, in which you're challenged. It takes all your attention to do it right, but you can do it right. It's not too hard. If it's too hard, then it's just frustrating. So it's challenging. You can do it right, and it's rewarding. Artists do this too. And if you can have a profession that allows you to be in the flow state some of the time, you're very fortunate. It's worth looking for. I have a student who did a whole dissertation on firemen, believe it or not, down in Florida. And they get in a flow state in a big fire.
Yeah, of course, the question is what's happening the rest of the time. But my question to you is whether or not there's research on any particular health benefits to being in that state or finding your...
Well, there's health benefits in being happy. And if you can be in a flow state, your stress level is much lower, even though you're excited, you're happy. And the evidence is that people who live for the into the future because they have things they want to do and like to do are healthier. And part of the reason they're healthy is it's no big secret. They just take care of themselves. They say, gee, like me, I'm almost 70 years old, not a lot of things I want to do yet. So I exercise and try to eat well and so on. So, you know, if I were just getting depressed, I wouldn't be doing those things.
Kari, I wonder, you and I are very much on the same page with the buffer, and we sound like we have spouses who maybe aren't. Over 30 years, we've come together in a lot of ways. My wife has realized it's just more fun to be around me, not anxious, and I've realized what Alan said, you know what, it's okay to be late. I wonder if that's happened to you over time, as you've thought about your relationship to time, if you've become any more relaxed about possibly being, should I say the word, late.
Yeah, I did have a little bit of a breakthrough a few months ago that I said, people aren't going to not like me if I show up late. I think that I had this thing from my childhood is that we were always late. My dad was always late, and I, you know, late for all the Christmas things and all the family get-togethers. And I felt like people were looking down on us or we weren't okay because we were always late. And I had this big realization that, my friends are, Julia's going to love me if I show up late. And, you know,
she'll prefer it.
And actually, I did show up late.
Or I'll think you're dead.
There's that.
So, yeah, I think I have relaxed about it. But, and it depends on how important it is. If something is really important, I am not going to be late. But if it's meeting a friend for coffee and I need to stop and get gas, I'm going to go ahead and do that and relax about it and not feel stressed.
You know, there are geographical differences. I don't know whether you remember the movie L.A. Story, in which Steve Martin goes to pick up his date for the evening for a party, and he gets over there, and she's changing one dress after another. She can't make up her mind. Then she tries several wigs, and he's going crazy. He finally gets her to the car. She says, you know, this dress doesn't look right. She goes back inside, changes a couple more times. Finally, they get to the party in L.A., and the host comes out and says, oh, you're the first couple here.
Got a good head start.
Yeah.
Alan, let me ask you this, because we're talking about these tensions we have in most relationships where one party has, you know, they have different ideas about time. I just wonder within cultures, because we as Americans have these kind of blunderbuss ideas about other cultures. Oh, they see time differently, and then we have this kind of monolithic sense.
Well, there are really differences. Philip Zimbardo, who's sometimes called Mr. Psychology, if you go online and look under YouTube, you can find some lectures and some animations of his work. But he's been all around the world and talked to people in different places and timed them, how fast time goes, how fast people walk, how impatient they get when they're in line. And there are big differences. For example, northern Italy, people are future-oriented. They're busy. They want to get things done. Southern Italy is just the opposite. They live in the present. It's what he calls present hedonistic. They like to take long times for meals, like to enjoy themselves, drink some wine, sleep late, have a, you know. And in fact, in Italy, there's a party that wants to separate northern from southern Italy because the people of the south just are sick of this stuff from the people in the north. There's a real difference between Protestants and Catholics. Protestants tend to be historically more future-oriented, more busy, etc. Catholics are more from Latin countries, and they tend to be more present-oriented. He divides people up into future-oriented, present-oriented, past-oriented, and then there's a positive and a negative for each of these.
Yeah.
And he finds big differences in countries. The closer you get to the equator, the more present-oriented, for example.
He's obviously got a lot of time to think that through.
Travel all around the world, and people, you know, that are future-oriented see present-oriented people as lazy. And,
right. Well, one thing I noticed in all 10 of the people I interviewed and built chapters in Good Busy is that the family experience, the growing up, so influences people. Kari obviously talks about having a father who made you late. Tom talks about compartmentalization and how that creates the ability to sliver. There's a practice that there's the last chapter in the book called Hunt with a woman named Sandy Dang from Vietnam who watched her father hunt for frogs in the middle of the Vietnam War.
That was a great chapter.
Thank you.
You've got great stories in this book. Let me recommend people should get this book and read these stories, whether they care about time or not. These are great stories.
Tell us it, yeah.
Well, you know, we focus on that in Sandy's chapter of Hunt, but literally all 10 practices are deeply embedded in people's relationship with time. And in my own experience, you mentioned the grandfather clock and the Elgin watch factory, and I woke up every morning to a father who couldn't wait to get to work. And at first, my feelings were a little hurt by that. And as I grew up, I realized I really wanted to go to work too. And so this relationship with time, yes, it can be tweaked and amended, but it's fundamentally there by the time you're, I don't know how old, quite young.
Well, and it kind of raises the question, Tom, I'll put it to you because we can just speculate on this about whether or not procrastination is some sort of genetic quality or just having a job or a task in front of you that you just don't like to do and looking for reasons not to get at it.
Yeah, well, I think it's that, but also, and I think it's, you know, one of the, those of us that maybe stay busier than others have multiple things we're desiring to do. So even when we want to procrastinate X job, there's mm-hmm. something else that can get a different kind of energy. And I think for me, a lot of the things I do require different levels of energy or different kinds of energy. So it's not, you know, if I had to do the same thing, if I had to do time, as they say, it would be very difficult. But you know, you've got a certain kind of work and another kind of work, and some of it's physical, some of it's totally mental, some of it's sedentary. I think that's, for me, the ideal life.
I wonder if this is kind of an abstract question, but for you as a photographer, when you frame a shot, when you think about a picture that's utterly visual, whether time, how time enters into your aesthetic.
Well, it is all about time. I photograph things that I like to think are emanating a sense of time or the passage of time. And also, you know, you are fixing an image when you photograph, and you're also putting a frame around it, which is a kind of containment process, and a not a natural process to draw a frame around something, but it's the same kind of frame you draw around a task or the goal for this afternoon. Time, you know, I said to Julia that time is a controlled substance, and I guess we all could go into treatment for our various addictions to the controlled substance
of time. And of course, Alan, I mean, it is, in a sense, a controlled and an artificial substance. I mean, it's helpful for humans to act in time because if you're trying to catch the antelope, knowing what path to take and how long it's going to take you to get there, that's a pretty good function. But really, do we have any good objective ideas? What are our ideas about time as a real thing?
Oh, nobody has a clue.
Yeah. What about a relationship between consciousness and the passing of time, though? Our ability to sense the way, how fast things are going. You know how we get older and summers pass faster and all that sort of idea.
Well, it's true. People experience time differently. I've forgotten which famous author said, "When you get to be 60, it's Easter every 15 minutes." but time does go a lot faster. I remember when I was a kid waiting for Christmas. It just took forever to get from, you know, from Thanksgiving to Christmas when I was a kid. Now it goes right by. But experience of time is, you know, it's partly a function of the brain, at least a big part. And it's subject to different chemicals. There are drugs that make time seem to go very fast or very slow. Marijuana is a drug that makes time seem very slow, for example.
An experience has a particular experience, acute experience, near death. People who are in an emergency where they're confronting imminent death have reported, at least, a sense
There's
of time stretching.
There's a real time contraction. Yeah. This was reported first by a mountain climbing club in Switzerland back in the 1890s, when people fell off cliffs. Survived to tell the story that on the way down, time just seemed to extend for them. Sometimes they'd hear celestial music and stuff too, but they began to notice that it happened in a lot of what you might call almost death experiences, in train wrecks and other things. That at the moment a person thinks that they're likely to die, they're going to die here in a car wreck or something. It's like things just slow down. That's true.
We are talking about time today. Julia O'Grady is the author of the book Good Busy. Alan Combs, a consciousness researcher and a professor emeritus from UNC Asheville. And our thanks to Tom Rankin and Kari Andrade, who shared their secrets for effective time management, or at least ideas about time, with Julia and with us. Up next, a historical perspective on how women have managed their time and how we've perceived women in time. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking about time, how we perceive it, how we use it, what it means to be busy, and is being busy a good thing? Julia Scatliff O'Grady is with us, author of the new book, Good Busy. Alan Combs is a consciousness researcher, professor emeritus from UNC Asheville. And joining us now is Lisa Levenstein, associate professor of history at UNCG. Lisa, welcome back to the program. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
I wonder, you've been listening to this conversation about time, and you teach a course in women's history. Do you think that women experience time differently than men do?
Well, what I know for sure is that our culture has always had very specific ideas about how women should be using their time, and that those ideas about women's time have often been very different from the ideas we've had about how men should spend their time.
And certainly, most recently, we hear that women, when they made their way into the workforce, then had to sort of manage these two worlds, the home front and the workplace, and be better time managers than they had been before.
Well, it's really interesting to look at how these ideas about women in the workplace have changed over time. So in the 1950s, we think about the idea of the ideal woman, or the woman that was, you know, represented in magazines and newspapers as being the, you know, suburban mother who focused on her family. Well, there was also actually new research has shown a competing ideal in the 1950s that was of women who pursued careers, but crucial to that ideal was the idea that women could pursue a career, but that their family would always come first. And so when people spoke about women in the labor force, it was always, they could be in the labor force, but they would always be putting the needs of their family first.
And, of course, it was always in terms of time. They would have to have enough time for their family, which was a value that was never placed on men.
Absolutely. In the 1980s and 90s, we heard a lot more about the time, this thing called the work-family conflict, right? The idea that the time women spent at work was conflicting and creating a kind of competing demand on them with the time they needed to spend with their families.
Go ahead. No, do finish.
And then I think now recently this has kind of morphed into this idea that the ideal for women is to achieve this, you know, I would say mythical ideal of work-family balance. That is, you know, somehow manage their time such that they would have, enough time to spend on their wonderful careers and also enough time to spend with their families.
Well, Julia, you said that when you tried to talk to men and you used that word balance, that's when they tuned out entirely. Is that right?
That's right. You can't say the word balance and keep a balanced audience. All of the men don't come to the seminar.
mostly women come to try to fix something they think they need to fix in their lives. And I think that's what you're talking about with the whole matter of balance.
What is it about that word? Do men feel somehow exempt from the issue of time management, or does balance sound to them like something that is less than manly? We don't balance. We work hard and we work until we drop, something like that?
I think there's so many progressive, wonderful, hardworking men in the home and at work. So I don't mean to say that there aren't men out there who don't think about balance. But when it comes to stepping into a room to talk about it, it doesn't happen.
Alan, you're a baby boomer, and you noted that the social demands on women did change dramatically in the 1970s.
Yeah,
is that right?
One of the things I remember, while being as old as I am, I'm not a baby boomer. I actually precede baby boomers by about 15 minutes. But I remember, I was at the 60s or late 60s, Lisa, that there was the women were going to be able to do everything. And they were going to have a family and friends, and they're going to have a career, and that was a big push. And what happened is, of course, people burned out. You just can't do it. I thought that was an interesting twist, and you know, I'm no expert on this, but as a psychologist, I think women have always been sort of pulled two or three different ways at once.
Well, I think that's really an interesting point, because I think we do today have this idea that in the 1960s and 1970s, the feminist movement was somehow promising women they could, quote, have it all, that they could have a demanding career, they could have a fulfilling family life. Well, that is really one of the many cultural myths about feminism that we have that really doesn't hold up to historical scrutiny. So, in fact, the feminist movement never promised women that they could have it all. In fact, key demands of the feminist movement had to do with the kinds of social supports that women needed to be able to combine work and family. So, you know, the feminist movement has been and, you know, continues to be very interested in issues about affordable and reliable child care, about paid maternity leave, paid sick days, flex time, but also
that's all European stuff.
Yes, but also even more basic things like higher paying jobs for women. You know, women tend to be in lower paying work, and the fact of the matter is, you can achieve, you know, a more, whatever you want to call it, balanced. You can negotiate the demands of work and family better if you are being paid more money. But there's another also really crucial message of the feminist movement of the 1970s that I think has been lost today, which is the idea that work in the home, the family part of the work-family balance, actually is labor. It is valuable labor. So when we say work-family balance, it's often that these two spheres of life are juxtaposed against each other, as if these are completely different elements of time, right? Work is work and family is a different kind of time. When in fact, when you look at, I would say, increasingly both men and women's experiences in the home, that the family time is a form of valuable, important labor, and labor is being done in the home in a way that often isn't recognized or valued in our culture.
And of course,
this is exhibited by many men who escape the house to go to work, so they can sit in their office at work, and life is easier there.
Well, but also it suggests that with the problem of commodifying labor, when you turn labor and you commodify a portion of it and don't commodify and put a dollar value on what is ultimately very valuable, which is home time, you're going to get this split. And then a lot of the tenets and imperatives of the feminist movement, which is an equitable workplace, a workplace that actually supports and sustains whole families, that's a message that's been lost, and certainly the question not even addressed today when we talk about jobs. We talk about creating any old job that'll simply make things worse instead of creating a workplace that allows families to actually spend time
together. There's a woman I interviewed in the book, Louisa Meacham, who her word was tunnel, and she took time several years out from teaching high school to be at home with her children. And her message was, it's a lot harder to be at home with my children than to be at work.
Yeah.
So it's a quiet, difficult secret that some of us keep, that it's actually easier at work than to be at home with our children.
Sure.
It's a micro concern looking at macro issues of work and labor, But I think it's something that we have to think about seriously, to admit that we like to be busy, that we want to be busy until we keel over.
Yeah. Well, it's a distraction from some of the deeper and more important issues that we face, as you suggest. Sometimes
it's home.
Not even
a distraction. That it's, for me, there's such an adrenaline rush to get things done. To be in a workplace, to be at a conference table and talk about issues, and then a day at home with sick children, that's so much more difficult.
Yeah. Lisa, are women still oppressed by this disparity that certainly we saw open up in the late 60s and 70s over how women are expected to manage their time versus men? Are women still expected to do it all and manage their time better and still be the primary caregivers in the home?
Well, I do think that the work-family balance image, the discourse around it is just an example of a new 21st century ideal that is being placed on women that most women find it impossible to achieve. So it's no longer the, woman at home baking cookies or whatever you might say it was in the 1950s, but that this is just another ideal that women are expected to live up to. And I think it's also really important to think about the fact that these ideals that we see in the newspaper or in magazines or on TV or wherever are very much almost always a middle class or elite woman's ideal, right? Those are the women who are being held up. And we hear so little about the struggles with time for poor women or working class women who have, who are also negotiating these competing demands of workplaces and family life, but in very different kinds of social conditions. We're talking about women who are taking the bus to a daycare center and then taking the bus to get to work and then taking the bus back to that daycare center. We're not talking about women. These are the kinds of time management concerns that we're speaking of, and I'm not seeing them getting a high from being busy in that kind of a way, right? Yeah. So it's a really different set of concerns that we don't think very much about or talk about that much in the public discourse.
Alan, what were you saying?
Oh, no, I agree completely. I don't remember what it was saying.
Well, it bring us back to this, are we distracting ourselves in a discourse that says, well, women should use their time or we should be more fair in our treatment?
Yeah, I guess what I was saying is where I live, we have a lot of Hispanic folks that have come up into California, and a lot of them work very hard. A lot of single parent families, and a lot of these people work two or three jobs. Time management's a different issue.
Well, but it raises the big question that it seems to me we never ask. How is it that we tolerate an economy that requires parents to be working 100% of their waking hours and then wonder why we're left with some of the social conditions that will inevitably produce?
Yeah, and you can ask yourself why we have some of the delinquency problems and crime rates among young people. Well, nobody's at home. The parent is maybe single parent working two or three jobs and exhausted. So
can we get around this question of how we use it? In other words, if we continually place a dollar value on time, and we do, the units per hour, wages per hour, can we ever get back to a time when we look at our time and the way we spend it in a more humane and sustainable way? How does a family sustain itself? How does a family best use its time? And what would that economy look like? Are we well beyond that conversation?
Well, I think a lot of European countries have exactly this.
Yeah. Well, what about here?
Value time at home, they value parents.
Yeah, I think it is a class issue. You're right. And when I interviewed Esther, who continues to be a bartender in Las Vegas and has a grown son, she was 20 when she had him, they worked out a lot of different systems together such that they had a work-life balance together. So I don't think it's really possible to figure out how people make sense. All I can do is, that's why I went out to interview people. I interviewed over 40 people and narrowed it down to 10 because I didn't feel confident that I knew the answers myself.
Let me tell a short story about students and their time management. We thought that the new students could benefit by hanging out with the A students that are seniors. So we sent them to do that, and it was a catastrophe because the really good students are all different. Some of them don't study at all and then cram at the last minute. Some of them have regular hours that they study. Some of them party all the time and then study and they don't sleep. It's different. Everybody's different.
I think I had to give up on it.
And I think time management has some of those traits as well.
Yeah.
I think, though, it's really important to remember that this isn't just – these issues are not just issues that reside within the individual. To get back to some of what you were saying before, Frank, that these are issues that are also profoundly shaped by our government, by policies, by things such as the minimum wage, by things such as are there child care centers available, by things such as, you know, is there paid maternity leave, is there paid sick days? All of these kind of – there is a role within these conditions, people that make decisions about their lives, but there is, a huge role for government and policy to play in shaping the way that people manage their time.
That's certainly true.
It's also interesting to see how people, you see now with we're in this political season, entitlements become an issue. We're hearing from voters on the street, well, people got to work for their money. We don't want to give money away, as though getting on two buses, working at a restaurant and a hotel, and then trying to get home and get your kids to appointments isn't somehow labor and is somehow less valuable than sitting at an office figuring out, how to move a hedge fund, for instance, which, requires I guess you burn a few calories doing that, but not as many as that woman on the bus. And it's amazing to me that we don't make that equation, that harvesting peppers or sweet potatoes in North Carolina, having come from a bus from Mexico, actually takes more energy than figuring out the next financial move and how you can wring value out of a company you just bought.
Yeah.
It's something that we don't do. So I guess it's time management. What have you learned? Julia, in doing this book, has it changed your ideas about time at all?
Well, the phrase that prompted the title, Good Busy, came from people saying, I'm afraid of bad busy. I don't want to be bad busy, but good busy is okay. And everyone had something imagined in their mind of what that looked like. Even in all of the paradigms that we've discussed today, certainly during the 20th century, early 20th century with the efficiency movement, that really does drive our sense of what business is supposed to be now. It gives us a sense of being productive. Being productive is about citizenship in our mind now. To be a citizen is to be someone who can pull their own
bootstraps. Pull yourself up by your own,
We can't just, if you can't be a productive member of this society, then you can't be a citizen. And that is very troubling, but that's kind of where we are.
I wonder if there's pressure. Lisa, let me leave the last question with you. Pressure on women to come up with a different definition of good busy for them.
Yes, I think that really comes down, what you were saying, Julia, about how we define what is productive labor, right? And that has always been a question that has been profoundly shaped by our ideas about gender, by class. What counts as productive labor that's part of citizenship, that means you're contributing to the economy? And we may all have our own individual definitions of that, but they're also profoundly shaped by the culture at large around us who might be telling us that the pepper picker isn't doing work that's as valuable as the hedge fund manager or isn't doing work that's as valuable as the woman who's on the bus bringing her child to daycare at 6 in the morning.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Lisa Levenstein, a professor of history at UNCG. Alan Combs, a professor emeritus at UNC Asheville, director of the Ellen. Professor emeritus
Center
in Asheville.
Consciousness Studies.
And, director of Center for Consciousness Studies at California Institute for Integral Studies in San Francisco. Thank you. Julia Scatliff O'Grady, author of the book Good Busy. She's going to be at the Center for Documentary Studies in Durham tonight at 7 o'clock. Saturday, September 15th at 2, she's going to be at McIntyre's in Pittsburgh. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you,
Frank. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.